Thank you, everyone, for coming to join for this session. I'm thinking right now, gosh, I really need to ditch a few things in my luggage because those are the things I want to take home. I want to, of course, first thank Gordy and the selection committee. It's trite to say that it's a tremendous honor, but you have no idea what it is to read the names on that list of prior winners. I'm sure that for many of them, stepping up to the same podium was a sort of validation of their life's work. For me, it's more of a heart palpitating, high pressure moment because I read it more as a mandate to somehow live up to Lucian Leap and Barbara Starfield and Lisa Iazzoni and Bob Brook and my current boss, Don Berwick, whom I'm hiding this award from in case he gets funny ideas about his expectations for me. So thank you very much. I knew that I would have some very, very warm feelings with this audience, and I'm very grateful to Gordy for having actually shown the quotes from Don Abedian that he did, because hopefully you'll see during my comments that completely in the same spirit. So you've actually caught me in this very interesting life transition. I never considered myself a lifer researcher. However, 8 years had passed, and I couldn't deny it anymore. But you know, there is something I think very magical about having watched all the drama and the high level of discourse and advocacy going on around healthcare reform debates the past 2 years. And I really felt if there was the time to enter public service, now was it. And I was actually grateful that I had waited as long as I did because I felt much more prepared to be helpful when I entered. So this is the new me. And I'll explain a little bit more about the Center for Innovation in a little bit, but my immediate boss is Richard Gilfillan, who is the interim director of the center, and we report to Don Berwick, which leads me to this. They said I could take my own time and go do this if I showed you this slide. I should say, it's not that I'm not guessing, it does reflect Don's views, but... So I wanted to explain to you why this transition was important to me, and I thought highly relevant to this session, because it has caused me to reflect. I've only been on the job about 3 weeks now, and I told Gordy, I think about now I've reached the appropriate metabolic rate for spending $10 billion over the next 10 years in implementing health reform. And it made me reflect on how on earth I got here. You know, what started this journey for me, and how did it land me here? And so I wanted to just give you a little bit of background that Gordy touched on, but I have to admit that when I saw his slide listing all of my research interests, I sat there thinking, oh my God, she looks like she's all over the place. You know, this kid has no focus whatsoever. But I knew that it wasn't true. I know that there was an underlying narrative, and I wanted to share that narrative with you. So my research career began when I basically conned my way into a job with the Population Council, conned my way into a grant from the Rockefeller Foundation, because I really just wanted to go to Vietnam for personal reasons. And I had to get a grant. And in order to get a grant, if one works backwards, you have to come up with a project. And in order to come up with a project coming from medical school and residency, well, you have to kind of pose as a researcher. And in order to do that, you have to have a research question. And that means you need to do the reading, the background, to figure out where the policy questions are in this little far-off country that you hadn't lived in over 20 years. So I did that. This was the pre-internet age. So I went to the library and I collected every peer review article there was on health in Vietnam. There weren't that many, luckily. You know, I knew that somehow I had to bring it back to reproductive health because the Population Council was going to be my sponsor, but I couldn't help straying. Wherever I started reading, my eyes just kept straying back to the same substack of articles on not health or healthcare, but public policy and politics and sociology. And what it talked about was the transition that Vietnam was going through as Soviet aid was being withdrawn after perestroika. And in light of that loss of support revenue, the Vietnamese were going through their doi moi, their new start, new beginning economic revolution. They were opening up the system to more entrepreneurship, and this included the healthcare sector, where they were beginning to allow physicians and other clinicians to see private sector patients in their own private clinics while at the same time staying employed in the public system. So I thought, well, what must that look like? I don't mean from up there, I mean inside those clinics. They go during the day and they see patients, and then at night they see patients. Are they seeing the same patients? Are they treating those patients the same way? Does anybody worry? So that's what the project evolved into, was a direct observational study looking at how the same physicians, within physician differences, and how they treated their public sector patients who paid low fees and perhaps something under the table, versus their private sector patients who were obviously willing to pay much more, including the medicines that their wives dispensed from the pharmacy attached to their clinic, or for ultrasounds for every kind of symptom you can imagine, from a sore throat to vaginal secretions. And so that was the study, and it finished, and I decided I was not an internationalist. I was a little too rambunctious for that society, and I wanted to come home, and I was coming home to a Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars stint at Hopkins, and the question was, what would I do there? And I thought, well, this seems an entirely translatable question to me. How do providers respond to financial and other incentives, and what does that mean for patients? And so that was what I noodled on for years in and out. And I hope to convince you that it is the unifying theme under all of those disparate research topics that you saw I worked on. So here's some of the things that I noodled on over the past 8 years. What happens when we pay less for the care, the same care, of some patients than other patients? And obviously, well, maybe not so obviously, but we wanted to demonstrate that it was obvious that what results is that you get segregated care for indigent patients, who are often minority patients, that are then compounded by the natural geographic segregation that has already taken place because of social demographics. And it results in gross healthcare disparities in access to care, access to insurance, access to specific types of providers, access to types of services. It results in gross disparities in care delivery. So you can access that service, but will you actually get it? Will it be offered to you? And will you be able to use it in a way that actually improves your outcomes? And no surprise, as a result, there are gross, nationally documented disparities in health outcomes. What happens when we set prices for services that neither accurately reflect how much it costs the provider to provide those services, nor accurately reflects the value, the clinical value of those services? Well, so if you pay cognitive services and primary care evaluation services far less than it actually costs for the physician to spend the 45 minutes building a care relationship, coordinating care, checking on medication reconciliation, shall I go on? And at the same time, you're paying lots and lots for the colonoscopy that really takes 10 minutes and hasn't been revalued in about 25 years. Well, unsurprisingly, providers end up delivering more of the well-reimbursed services and less of other services. And as a direct result of that, patients get some services they don't really need, and other patients get some services, don't get services that they do need. Entire specialties that are linked to different types of misvalued services become endangered species. As of last year, roughly 2% of graduating medical students were committed to going into primary care. And lastly, the chase for profits drives up healthcare spending without any improvement or without proportional improvement in the quality of care. And what that results in is overall lower value care. What happens when we pay for units of care rather than care of the whole patient? If you don't pay for something, things don't get done. If we had perfect knowledge when we were making up the physician fee schedule and we knew every possible service that patients ad infinitum into the future might need, and we listed that in the fee schedule, well, then we're set. We're golden. I don't think even Paul Ginsberg, my former boss, who was there and built the fee schedule, felt that way. And even he would be the first to say, we didn't pay for the things we really want, like care coordination. When you pay for units of service and you fragment the provider's view of their patient into this bit that is receiving the bit of care that I'm providing, responsibility for the outcomes of a given patient become opaque to all the providers who are involved and diffuse. And if everybody is driving, then nobody is driving. It results in fragmented, discoordinated care. And providers themselves feel, I think, hostage to the system, because if they're getting paid for units of care and not for the things they wish they could be doing but that aren't paid for, they can't move those dollars around to make investments that they know would be the right things to do. So what does the world look like if you follow the money? Payment policy is what is a major contributor to undervalued primary care, to suboptimal care quality, to unhealthy market trends that don't meet the population's needs and certainly are not fiscally sustainable, care fragmentation, and healthcare disparities. So how do we go about making that better? I had the privilege, the advantage of seeing David's talk before he saw mine. So I know that David is going to address some of these issues head on, but I wanted to talk about this at a policy level rather than at a clinical intervention level. So, you know, you can think of changing the world as I sometimes try to grapple with it in strategic terms. Do you want to go retail or do you want to go wholesale? Here's what retail might look like. This is a bike courier in New York City, possibly almost getting run over, but it's extremely focused, high-touch service, and it almost guarantees that that little parcel will go from where it started to where it's supposed to go. The problem is lots of parcels need to get delivered, and everybody who has a parcel wants to get it delivered on time to the right person. And each parcel is as important to the person who is sending and receiving it as the next. So maybe this is what wholesale looks like. Okay. A celebrated UPS and its re-engineered, efficient system of delivery that somehow still makes me feel like every parcel I send is as important as the next parcel and is guaranteed to arrive where it's supposed to go. Because there's huge disappointment if the Christmas presents from the grandparents don't arrive on time. But what makes UPS special is not their fleet of trucks and planes, it is not the computer system, it is not the software. They understand that technology, as Gordy and Donna Bedian pointed out, doesn't guarantee anything. Technology does not guarantee you the outcomes you want. Technology has to be designed and intertwined with reliable systems with multiple checks. The willingness to do a root cause analysis whenever anything goes wrong, a commitment to continuously improve those systems, an ethic of responsibility and teamwork, and what I think is the most important and so easy to forget in policymaking is reverence for the individual customer, which in this case is the patient, not the physician. As many times as they knock on our doors to lobby, it is not the clinician, it's the patient we're supposed to be worrying about. So what would wholesale translation of Donna Beedien's vision look like at the health policy level? And I ask the question this way: how do we achieve a system of healthcare delivery that invests in the appropriate infrastructure, perfects proven processes, and optimizes both patients' and society's outcomes? And how do we use policy to do this? Which makes me ask, what is policy? I think growing up, which is to say after college, because no one explained to me what policy was until after college, I think of it as the joint public expression of our underlying values. But really, isn't it the joint public expression of our often conflicting values? And this makes me think of a story from my motherhood life, which is that, you know, I live on Capitol Hill, which is this very gritty urban neighborhood, covers about 18 blocks east of the Capitol, of the U.S. Capitol. And when I first arrived, there was a parents' listserv called MOTH, Moms on the Hill. It was little back then, which meant like 300 families. It now has 1,500 families. And I was friends with the group, the small group of women who were the moderators for this group. Well, it just got so big, and there were so many contentious issues being discussed, that they got frustrated. They couldn't voice their own personal opinions because, you know, it wasn't seemly for the moderators to get all hot and heavy under the collar, and you were talking to 1,500 families. It's a big neighborhood. So what they decided to do was to create a new persona named Roxanne. And Roxanne became a member of the listserv, but Roxanne had several different personalities. And when Roxanne felt the need, she would argue with herself, and sometimes argue with herself and voice extremely differing opinions in the same hour. It was just madness flying back and forth, but it took care of a lot of frustration. So that's what number two makes me think of. And now that I'm on the inside, I actually see policy as number three, which is the well-intentioned but necessarily fractured, fragmented expression of our conflicting values. And this is how I try to get through my day today, is I'm not trying to effect policy as perfection. I'm trying to solve an unsolvable problem, and I know that the solution will be imperfect. It's an optimization exercise. And as long as I'm honest about that, hopefully people on the receiving end of the policymaking will be forgiving. So how are we going to change the way the money flows so that when we follow the money in the future, we'll be happier with where it leads us? I just wanted to summarize what I think are the key Medicare provisions in the Affordable Care Act that touch on payment policy to providers and I think could have a real impact on that circle of effects that I showed you. The Act increases the prices paid for cognitive services, those evaluation and management services. It funds demonstrations and pilots of medical homes and augmented primary care services in safety net settings as well as other settings. It experiments with two very, for Medicare, philosophically radical notions. One, that you can provide, you can give providers evidence-based payment. This is very narrowly targeted at the moment, only at radiologists, but it basically will not pay for services that it does not deem necessary based on clinical guidelines. It's a narrow range of imaging services, but boy, that is a radical departure because when the fee schedule was conceived, it was with the explicit understanding that Medicare was not to make judgments about the clinical value of services. It was merely to set prices based on their costs of service provision. So this is very radical. And then value-based payment, which is to say, by I think it's 2015, every physician's payment rates, reimbursement rates, will be jiggered up or down based on their quality performance across the board. The Act creates a shared savings program for accountable care organizations, which are groups of providers who come together and jointly accept responsibility for outcomes of a population of patients. It mandates that Medicare give physicians feedback on how much money they're spending and also on their quality performance. And obviously, the Affordable Care Act built on incentives that had already been put in place for adoption of information technology. The Act also changes or tries to change how we do business. So how we, the UPS analogy in policymaking, are going to be more streamlined and efficient and responsive to our customers. It creates the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation with real investment dollars, $10 billion appropriated over the next 10 years to do rapid cycle testing and evaluation of new payment models and new care delivery models. It gives the Secretary unprecedented latitude to expand or terminate those models based on early results without having to go back to Congress. It mandates that the Secretary regularly review Medicare's payment rates rather than having the physicians at the AMA and the Relative Value Update Committee re-examine them every 5 years. And it creates an independent Medicare advisory board that will make binding recommendations to Congress on whether to change payment rates so that the program remains fiscally sustainable. I would like to think the intent, the legislative intent, was to make this one payer, but by extension, the rest of the healthcare market, more responsive, more creative, and collaborative in its solution seeking, to induce judicious risk taking. $10 billion, that's a nice sum of money for what you can think of as a venture capital firm. And I think the vision was wholesale change, not retail change. So this is where I hope it would get us. This is my audacious aspiration, that payment policy in the future, re-engineered, will get us better health, better care, lower per capita costs, healthy market trends that are actually responding to what we need rather than what the payment policy says we need, coordinated and integrated care, healthcare equity, and highly valued primary care. Before I get to that, for this particular audience, I guess I should just take a step back and explain where I'm coming from, although I know you're sitting there thinking, I thought she'd just explain where she's coming from. You know, all of this fills my day and is extremely important and makes my creative juices run. But I know why I'm doing this. I'm not doing this because I think perfect medical care will solve the world's problems. I'm doing this because perfect medical care, at its best, will contribute roughly 10% to the health outcomes of the population while soaking up 99% of the costs. I do this because I'm trying to save money for you to do your public health thing. So what would Don Abedian say? How would he grade our quality of healthcare policy making? Would he assess that we've got maybe 70% of the necessary structure after the Affordable Care Act, possibly 50% of the appropriate processes, although the research here is pretty squishy, if at all? I would love for some IT entrepreneur to come up with a health policy video game so that we can collect evidence on what policies work and what don't. And certainly, we've not yet produced the desired outcomes. But I think the moment is ripe, and I'm really excited to go back to work. Thank you.
I think we'll be, I would take one burning question or clarification question, but otherwise, I would like to get to David's presentation.
Just to announce that the sign-up sheet is going around. The reason we're passing it is it helps us to design programs. So if you're interested in this sort of presentation about quality, it helps to know where you're from and have your email so we'll let you know. So we should pass it around. Okay. So that's why we're collecting.
I do see a hand. Go ahead.
I was just wondering. as keeping the cut in place so they can save money? Or do you see this more with the primary care doctors really concerned that we would provide care to a better care population?
So before I answer, I just want to reiterate that these are my personal views. And I'm among friends, right?
People who may not know what SGR is.
Sorry, the sustainable growth rate policy mandates for the past decade or so has mandated that each year that Medicare spending on physician services exceeds the target growth rate, that the subsequent year payment rates have to be cut a proportionate amount in order to make up that deficit. And every year since the SGR has been exceeded, Congress has been punting this and letting the payment rates float up with inflation or a little bit below inflation anyway because of the physician lobby. And frankly, because it's a bad policy, it's a very, very big hammer to use on some very, very delicate problems that require really neurosurgery and not a giant hammer. There's broad consensus about this, the policy must go. There's just not the spine to do it. This particular year, I am actually grateful the SGR exists. Not because I think it will be enforced, I know for a fact that it won't be enforced, but man, it's going to make Republican